There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shack of
a
sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there and welcome to Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute. And alongside me, as usual, is Maria Tafaga. Dr. Tafaga is a senior lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations. G'day there, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I am well, although somewhat chastened or bruised, I think it's fair to say, as a result of the referendum we've just been through. I didn't make any secret of the fact that I was an enthusiastic yes voter, and it was an emphatic result in the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for anyone who supported the yes campaign, it was a tough weekend.
It was because it wasn't just sort of missed out on the second hurdle. You know, the majority of states, for example, perhaps got there on the overall vote across the nation or came close. It wasn't anything like that at all. It was an emphatic defeat.
There's no really way to sort of sugarcoat it. And to be blunt, I was surprised. I mean, I didn't think the referendum was in a position to succeed, but I was shocked at the fact that it's come out with the yes votes come out with a three in front of it. That was shocking.
Yeah. It is very. It went from divisive to decisive, I think, was one way of putting it. Now, look, to talk about this in a much more structured way with some genuine expertise, I want to welcome back two professors who've been on here before. Nick Biddle is Professor of Economics and Public Policy. He's also Associate Director of the Centre for Social Research and Methods here at ANU. G'day there, Nick.
Hey, Mark. Nice to be back on. Hey, Maria.
Hello.
And also with us is Professor Matt Quartrup. He's a political scientist, he's a legal scholar from Coventry University.
That's right.
And he's a visiting fellow at the ANU School of Law. He's a widely regarded as a global expert, perhaps the global expert on referendums. He's looked at them all over the world, and he's been on here before. It's welcome back to you as well, Matt.
Thank you, Mark.
Matt, I might start with you, really, because you did predict this result. As Maria said, it wasn't a hard thing to predict as we got closer to it. The polling wasn't just fairly dire for the yes side, but it was consistently so and had been there for a while. But I think you predicted it a lot further back than that for a range of reasons.
Yeah, I think it was November last year. And I have a bit of form on this, I suppose. I predicted Brexit as well. It's not because I have a crystal ball or sort of prophetic powers. It's really down to, and we'll come back to that, I suppose, econometrics and forecasting models. And there are a number of factors that you see in referendums. If you have compulsory voting, you can knock another 7% off the starting line in referendums, which is typically 56%.
Can I just stop you there just for a sec? Because, I think I understand the point you're making there, but let's just expand that out a bit. Essentially, compulsory voting, widely regarded as a plus for Australia. It makes elections, very much contests in the middle ground and so forth. It's a stabiliser. But for referendums, it kind of almost works the other way, where it actually drags people to the polling booth who perhaps aren't particularly engaged in a question. And
yes, it's interesting.
Those people tend to break no if they don't understand it.
Well, they more than 10, they'd be sort of 9 out of 10 would tend to break no. So that in referendums roughly around the world, you see the same thing in Chile, for example.
So these are people then that in many cases wouldn't attend were it not compulsory.
Yes, and then they feel if I really have to attend, it has to be bloody good, pardon my French. Mm. And then most of the time they have to be educated on things. And as a general rule, when people have to start reading up on the subject, they become more skeptical. So when you had the postal survey on marriage equality, that was an issue that people had made up their minds a long time ago. Mm-hmm. They knew roughly what to think about it. And therefore, if you've made up your mind on an issue, you're less likely to be swung over to the other side, but not
and
so.
And that was a plebiscite, and it was voluntary as well.
Yes, but it a referendum in all but name, really. You know,
except that it was voluntary.
It was voluntary, yes, and also that meant that the turnout from memory was only 63% or something like that, which would be high in any other country.
Yeah,
but because probably Australians have been socialised into that.
I might bring you in here, Nick. You've been crunching numbers, mm-hmm. right? You've done a lot of research, and of course, we've just had some fairly definitive mm-hmm. data come in the form of the vote, and there's now a lot of work to be done trying to understand that vote and understand why people mm-hmm. went the way they went and why they did it so decisively. Yep. Tell us, if you can, what the actual nature of the data you've got is.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a range of data which you can use to try and answer, peel apart, see what's happening. So one source of data which people have already started using is kind of area level, kind of electorate data. And I think that's gives you a bit of an indication of how the area in which someone lives predicts their vote. And I think there's a reasonably consistent story emerging from that, although we might get into a little bit later, it's a little bit more complicated when you really start to dig into the data. But I think to really understand what was driving people's votes, what some of the nuances are, you do need kind of individual level data, survey data, where you can ask people about a range of issues, some direct questions, maybe some indirect questions, and then tie their views on those issues to kind of how they would vote if you're doing it pre-referendum or how they did vote post-referendum. So for our data set, we've been asking kind of a consistent referendum question all of this year. So we asked in our January poll, we asked in our April poll, and we asked in our August poll.
This is the ANU poll for everyone out there.
Exactly, ANU poll, where we ask a range of questions. We ask about well-being, we ask about financial stress, we ask about kind of voting intentions.
And it uses a consistent sample group.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the strengths of our data is we're able to not only see how things are changing at the national level, so like a repeated cross-section, and what we're able to see is how individuals are changing in their vote. And that gives you maybe a slightly different kind of take on how people tracked over the referendum campaign. And just to kind of follow up, so we've been doing kind of surveys pre a referendum, and today actually we're recording on Tuesday, we go into the field for our post referendum survey. And once again, the power of our data when it becomes available will be that we know what people said they were going to do in August, what they were going to do in April, and how they ended up voting, and kind of tie that to a range of both kind of political issues, demographic characteristics, as well as some specific views on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kind of peoples and issues.
Yeah, so to make it clear, I suppose, for listeners, like what's the difference between Nick's data, panel data from the ANU poll, and the sort of analysis you're seeing in the newspapers is essentially Nick has individual level data. So he knows their level of education, he knows their preferences on a bunch of different matters. When it comes to the sort of referendum votes, like it's the absolute what people actually voted, but essentially we're kind of making probabilistic assumptions based on where people live. But we can't actually then go back to those individuals in the seat of Edmonero, for example, and say, therefore they are old, white, male and voting no or whatever, right?
And the real clear example of this, which has been picked up in the media, is when you look at the proportion of the electorate which identifies as Indigenous in the census, then a higher proportion of Indigenous peoples in the electorate is associated with a lower yes vote. And a very simple interpretation of that would be, well, Indigenous people voted no. But clearly that's not the case when you start to look closer to individual level
data. Booth level data.
Exactly. Yeah. And even booth level data is complicated because not everyone votes in their own booth. And also I think the census is a couple of years old now, and people move and kind of area characteristics change through time. But our data, and we can get into some of the other explanatory variables a bit later, it's August, so it's a couple of months before the referendum, but clearly shows that Indigenous Australians were far more likely to say they would vote yes, even when you control for a range of other characteristics. So a low-income, high-income Indigenous Australian more likely to vote yes than a low-income or a high-income non-Indigenous Australian.
Mm. And the booth data we now see from electorates like Lingiari in the Northern Territory show that quite strongly. So there was this big contest in the sort of rhetorical contest, pretty dishonourable, I thought, through the latter part of the campaign, where there was a lot of people challenging this idea that most Aboriginal people wanted the voice, wanted to see this referendum succeed. And the No campaign, various elements of it, were advocating a position that this wasn't true, that that Aboriginal Australia was, cleaved down the middle, as it were, or something close to it. There was nowhere near kind of support for it. But what we see from that data in those seats where there's a very high proportion of Indigenous constituents, that overwhelmingly they were voting in favour of yes. So that goes to the point you just raised, really. In those electorates where you have a high level, a high proportion of Indigenous voters, you also see a propensity, as you were just saying, to vote no, which is not necessarily the Indigenous people. It's the others.
Exactly.
Now, what does that speak to?
Yeah, look, I think there's a few interpretations of that. And you do see similar things in kind of related polls when you look at votes on issues with migration, even a kind of those born in a particular country, they will be influenced by the characteristics of those in the area, even if migrants, for example, vote in a very different way. So I think there's a couple of potential interpretations. I mean, one is if you think about it, who is likely to perceive that they're going to be impacted by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians having a greater say over policy? Well, it's those who live in areas where Indigenous Australians live.
Yeah.
Now, that perception might not be based on the reality of what was actually in front of them in the
It doesn't
the
have
vote.
To be based on facts.
Exactly.
It just has to be based
perception.
On a fear.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. So another way of putting that is that people who are close to the interface between white and black Australia, have lived experience of it, who may themselves be quite economically marginalised, may be inclined to think, well, this cohort of people is about to get something that I don't have, which was a pretty strong kind of trope through the
And look, I think the No campaign probably didn't use these terms very often, but did frame it a little bit like a zero-sum game.
Absolutely.
And if you're living in an advantaged electorate where you're not reliant on kind of support from government, where there's very few other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living in your area, then that message will be far less salient than, as you said, if you're relatively disadvantaged, you're living in an area where there are a largish number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in your area, you're likely to be more amenable to an argument on a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Maria, the referendum, the form itself, right, it strikes me there's this big mismatch in it. We've just seen it play out quite dramatically, which is that you have by definition almost, you have this tightly constrained binary question that is put to voters. There's no grades within it. You're either for it or against it, right? But the debate itself is nowhere near as constrained. It can run off in 100 different directions, which only goes to, in a sense, the difficulty you have with analysing these things after the fact, which is, there's a multiplicity of reasons why people may have gone one way or the other.
Yeah, and it kind of goes to the conversation that you guys were just having before, right? So I'd sort of say two things is that, the reality is that it's pretty clear that a lot of voters weren't really clear on what the content of the question really was and the sort of the narrow scope of the question, okay? And that's sort of reflected in the debate that was often on many issues adjacent to the actual issue itself and the sort of discourse around that. And I mean, I think one of the things that really brought it home for me was I was handing out flyers, and then the next time I'd handed out the flyers, the flyers had changed, and it had a little diagram of what the voice was actually supposed to be, like a really simple, clear diagram. And it sort of struck me that this simple message of what this proposal is, this essentially this sort of committee, right, a permanent committee, which doesn't have any veto powers or legislating powers, what this proposal is, and that's not really what we're discussing as the sort of everyday bread and butter events. And it kind of goes to the problem or the difficulty, which you've already alluded to, Nick, around trying to understand what this data means, because quite clearly the data is extremely noisy. The referendum data, the data from the AEC, like it's just one question. Like, did you vote yes or no on this question, when we don't actually have a good measure on whether or not, like, what people actually understood the question to even be, right? Precisely. So there's this whole bag of concepts surrounding this debate, and that's actually very difficult to disentangle. And even when you've got stronger or individual level data, which I think we're about to talk about, even if you find correlates, right, these are non-random patterns controlling for other potential factors that might influence outcomes, right? They're non-random patterns in the data, which is why we think they're significant, right? Mm. You know, showing a relationship between age and vote choice, for example. But why it is that older Australians might have voted against the voice is not directly clear from this data. It's ultimately an interpretation. And I think what this debate has kind of revealed is that there are multiple mechanisms at play, and it's difficult for us to say which ones were more significant or salient for each individual voter, or which multiplicity of factors were in that person's bag, or which was the most salient factor, like i.e. which had the biggest effect size, which is why the debate around what the vote means is so varied, right? Mm-hmm. And we're unlikely to achieve a consensus beyond understanding certain demographic features, associations with vote choice.
And just to add a really quick bit of data to that. So in our August survey, 44% of people said that they still don't know about anything about the voice. This was in August. And then we got, that's not even the strongest view. There's people, it was like about a little under 5%, who didn't even know the voice existed. So there's, obviously, August is still a couple of months, and knowledge would have picked up a little bit, but we can't kind of assume that people are going into it with, you know, really precise views of what they're doing, what they're voting on. So you're trying to, it's like the nailing jelly to a wall type analogy. It's really hard to pin down what people are actually voting on, and therefore what it says about people's broader attitudes on a range of, either on the question itself or on a range of topics.
Yeah, what we have is like more likely or less likely scenarios. Sorry, Matt.
That's okay. No,
that's too much of a gentleman to just sort of barge.
One tries. I think that a lot of the blame also has to be with the political class. Referendums tend to be won if you have bipartisan support. In Ireland, they pretty much always have it. When they tried to reform the Senate, they didn't have it. It went down in flames. In Switzerland, where they also have the double majority, only 6 out of over 200 referendums on constitutional changes have failed because they always had bipartisan support. If you then add to that, it was a catalogue of all the things. I think I've covered now 41 referendums, my 41st referendum, which makes me really nerdy. But one of the things that we always see in referendums, we have to have a credible spokesperson who is able to very clearly articulate what's going on. We had the minister who could only read from a script, who came across as being not very sort of passionate about it. The government decided, the Yes campaign decided not to quite reveal what it was all about. Well, it will be legislated for later. So that also is not great. Then you have you have the celebrity endorsement. We know from the Brexit campaign, like David Beckham came out and supported Brexit.
I think when we last had you on, you did a David Beckham impression.
I did a Beckham impression. I can do that if you want me to. and I can't do the Stephen Hawkins one because that would be rude.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawkins also, you know, a lot about astrophysics, but not necessarily why you have to stay in Europe. Now, you had the first thing that happened when I landed in Australia last year was that to me, unknown American basketball player, larger than life, even taller than you, Nick, was advocating, as you think, an American basketball player coming in and trying to tell that people sort of can smell that.
I was told at the time, you know, sort of by the spinners that this was a piece of genius. This was speaking to kids off the main track
Well, that's what they said with Andy Murray came out. Let's do it, Scotland. That was my Andy Murray impression.
Yeah. And the only not thing so that, good that one.
Not quite okay, but. David Beckham's a bit closer to home, isn't it? And the only thing that happened there was he was booed next year at Wimbledon. And here we had Qantas, of the company that was, came out in favour of this. Mm. So you had Qantas celebrity endorsements and a minister who couldn't articulate it and not bipartisan support. So it's almost like, when I'm writing a book on this, it's going to be a chapter on how to lose a referendum. I mean, it's a tick box exercise.
You just need to line up these factors and you can guarantee you'll lose.
But then I suppose the other thing, which is listeners might want to know, is that the opposition, the leader of the opposition, was very triumphalist and talking about how this is going to bulldoze them into power. All the teal seats voted yes. And as a general rule in Australian referendums, and indeed referendums elsewhere, is that governments lose referendums and win subsequent elections.
Yes.
And it's often a thing that sort of make them focus a bit. And I noticed that
they also win referendums and get re-elected as well.
Or they win
John Howard did.
Yes, well, John Howard was slightly odd one because he was the
proposed had been a referendum, but he wanted it to lose and it lost, and then he got re-elected in 2001.
Yes, but if you go back and you look at sort of Australian history, Menzies lost a referendum in 1951, and he came very heavily for it. Whitlam and Hawke also lost referendums, but they were a little bit more sort of lukewarm, staying behind. But Menzies is an example of a guy who really nailed his colours to the mast, and the Labour Party in the early 50s. Basically got tainted with association with the communists.
Yes, yes.
And therefore it took literally decades for them to get back there because they had sort of consorted with people who were unpalatable. And I think that could be the danger.
There was a few other factors as well. I mean, you know, basically the Labour Party split and 54-55.
Yes, but subsequent to that, because then there were the sensible ones and the non-sensible one, if as it were.
Yeah.
And I think the same could repeat itself here. That Dutton and his associates have been linking up with people who were saying things that weren't necessarily helpful in terms of looking mainstream. And also, I think this idea that he said, well, there could be a second referendum, now he's backpedaling on that.
It was always disingenuous, frankly.
Yes.
And you could tell at the time. And it didn't even wait 48 hours to, as you say, backpedal away from
it. No, but you can now start quoting him and then say, well, didn't you say?
I don't think he cares, Matt. I mean, I think he's demonstrated pretty clearly he will say or do whatever it takes to get the headline.
Oppositions can have hubris as well, which is, I guess, what you're saying.
Yes, but the voters might care. I mean,
they just lined up 6 out of 10 in favour of the position he was advocating. So,
yes.
You know,
but a referendum is where you're allowed to have your cake and eat it. You can support a party and then take a different position. And I think 65% of cases, people want to have what I sort of call, you know, the bespoke democracy. We don't want package deals anymore. We roughly agree with the party, but then we have our own views on gay marriage or The Voice or whatever.
We're just going to quickly go to a break and we'll continue this discussion.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Nick, you were itching to say something. Away you go.
Look, I was just going to add something a little bit to kind of the political implications. So there's the other kind of factual comparison is kind of Rudd in kind of 2010 and his kind of pulling back from his strongly held views or strongly stated views on climate change.
The great moral challenge of the
time. So I think, we don't really know what's going to happen over the next year and a half.
Sorry, can I just tease that out a bit though? What do you mean it's a counterfactual in this sense?
An alternative approach which Albanese could have taken, which was stating very strongly his view on a voice to Parliament and then pulling back and kind of distancing.
So this is about whether he could have at some point during the last 18 months decided that now is not the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think he could have done that.
Mm.
I think he could have looked at the cost of living crisis, for example, and the data and what it was showing, and he could have said that in the interests of the referendum itself, as well as in the respect for what Australian voters were clearly wanting the government to focus on, that now was not a propitious time to be going to a referendum, that the government remains absolutely committed to it, but we believe that given the economic circumstances, each would compromise each other in the voters' minds and that they could have put it on hold. The other argument that he could have added to that was that we do need to build a stronger cross-party consensus in relation to this because, as we all know, as we've been saying here, bipartisanship is a fundamental prerequisite for success, and without it, it's just a big long exercises. It's a pretty big cost that we've just paid. And I'm not talking financially, it was $450 million or whatever, but that's the small cost, really. This issue has been significantly set back by the way this has been handled and failed.
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to that. One is kind of what the chances of success for a voice to Parliament and also the cost to principally Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for the discussion, which has kind of taken place during the referendum. And I agree that there's kind of arguments for it against whether to have kind of doubled down and pursued versus kind of pulling back and finding a different time. But I do think that there is a risk kind of coming into whether the May 2022 election, one of Albanese's really strong kind of arguments was, we're going to do what we said we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have been politically challenging to have pulled back from that.
But it could have been put with the election, with the election in 2025, right? Yeah. So it's effectively a first term promise, right? I'm delivering it in the first term, in the sense that we're actually having the referendum commensurate with the general election. There's some evidence to suggest that those referendums actually go better than ones midterm. I don't know whether you've seen any of that.
It's often the other way around.
In Australia?
Not necessarily.
My understanding is in Australia. We have pretty small sample size for success.
Yes.
Here,
so overall, people are actually able to, to have. To distinguish between measures and men, as we say in Britain. I remember in Ireland when they had the first presidential election where De Valera was going to be elected. He came in as president, with 90%, and he wanted at the same time to change the electoral system to first past the post because that would be great. And that was rejected by, significant majority because Irish thought, we like him as president, but we don't want him to be all powerful. So I think people are able to, which is a good thing, really, that they're able to distinguish.
As long as they're not just voting on the atmospherics of it. We've seen a lot of voting on the atmosphere. One we've just had.
I don't know.
Was he proposing a system that unambiguously advantaged him, or was
his party was by far the largest, but they didn't have a majority because it was PR. It was pretty obvious.
Made sense,
yes. But I think in this particular case, a referendum also has to be a credible answer to a credible problem.
Yeah.
And there, and I think it has to be, I think the ancient Greeks even had sort of theories about it and said, well, if you want to win an argument, you need to have, you need to be a credible person. You need to have a simple logic of why this works, and you need to have a passion or pathos, logos, and ethos is the Greek words if you want to have it. And in this case, there wasn't that. It was quite sort of say, well, if we give people a voice, then they will be able to make representations. But it's very difficult to see how that directly links to lower alcoholism and so on.
Yeah, I agree. I always thought this was a weak link in the argument. That, I mean, I understood the argument and
yes,
I felt that it was...
Well, that's because you're a politico, yeah. But if you're the guy who's really more interested in the footy and standing down the pub and whatever, then it's not quite obvious.
And it had this other problem that the Republic had, Maria, which was, you know, the Republic was, the change to the Republic was the minimalist model was simultaneously big and small, right? And this was a bit the same, right? It was a significant change worth doing, but it's an advisory committee, you know? So voters were kind of wrestling with this idea that it's historic, that it's significant, and yet at the same time they were, if they had concerns about it going too far, they were being counseled, look, it has no power. It has, all it has is an advisory capacity. It doesn't run programs, doesn't do this and that. Is there an oil and water aspect to that?
To a degree, I think it was solvable. Like part of the issue, I suppose, that might have been confusing for some people was that the act of recognition is the creation of an institution. Not, as a lot of people suggested, a two-part question. That's why it wasn't a two-pronged question on the ballot, okay? The act of recognition was the creating this new institution that would take on this representations role, which is a word that was not explained, which has, as we've sort of talked about before, representation, like it has, you know, voice dimensions where you say things and ask to be listened to, and it has accountability functions. And the accountability bit was the bit that was never
underplayed massively.
It was not explained, and that's the bit where the person down the pub might join the dots, for example. But I guess what actually, like, before we run out of time, I actually want to dig into Nick's data, because he's actually identified, he's looked at sort of seven different variables as to what might be driving kind of voting patterns, some of which I think have been sort of quite well ventilated in the media, and some of which have been sort of less so. So, yeah, Nick, do you want to tell us about what you found?
Yeah, so as I said, this is similar analysis to which others have been doing, but also similar kind of variables which we've included in our individual level analysis kind of pre-referendum. So there's a few kind of narratives which are really supported by the data, and one is around kind of the education cleavage. And certainly we find with both our individual level data as well as the area level data that if you have a degree, or in particular a postgraduate degree, or if you live in an area where with a lot of people with education, then you're far more likely to support the yes vote. So that's kind of, no matter how you look at that data, that's one of the key predictors of either individual or area level vote.
Is it also a key predictor of income?
Yeah, so that's the complication, which is that there's also a narrative that, oh, it's because of cost of living pressures, it's because kind of low income kind of people deserted the vote, and that there's some superficial evidence for that. So if you just looked really simply at electorates with high income, electorates with low income, that those with high income were more likely to vote yes. But of course, we also know that those electorates with high income also tend to be those with high levels of education. Those individuals with high income tend to be those with high levels of education. When you take that factor out, either really simply or with more complicated models, what you find is that low income at the individual level, at the household level, at the area level, controlling for education, predicts a yes vote. So it's not that low income people are resistant to the voice. It's also, when you look at kind of a range of adjacent measures, which we've been talking about related to Indigenous policy, that income doesn't correlate in the way which it does, it kind of it really simply. So I think it is true that I think the cost of living debate, where I think that was important is because of perceptions of government and perceptions of focus. And also the reality is that the Treasurer was, who is a very kind of strong spokesman for Labor, he was focused on other things. And so I think that matters. But in terms of individuals who are more likely to be affected by cost of living pressures being less likely to vote yes, I don't think the evidence supports that.
Well, I think the argument there in the political discourse around it was that the issues like this, which are kind of abstract for most people, like as the voice was, tend to tumble down the list of preoccupations when you're really struggling to pay the mortgage and you've got school fees coming up, or you know, the car needs repair or whatever it is, and so people are hurting out there in the suburbs, right?
Yeah, and I think that
and
affects-
then they start to resent the idea that there's this sort of dominant every time they turn on the television or the radio, there's this debate going on which isn't about that.
I think possibly it kind of affects kind of issue salience in that people have other things on their mind. But if you look at the most strongest no campaigners and the strongest no voters, they weren't low income either.
No,
if you have time to care passionately about an issue, then then that's, or if you have the feeling that you're in a position in society where you can strongly argue your case, then I think you fall to the mud to the extremes.
So you basically, it sounds like what you're arguing is that sort of socialization processes that pre-exist this vote are likely to be more impactful, right? Which relates to your results on partisanship.
Yep.
Why don't you walk us through those?
Yeah. So if you said you would vote Liberal, either individually or if you live
this
in
this is in the ANU poll, by the way, the panel data.
Sure. Yeah. But it holds with the electorate level data as well. So controlling for these other factors, Liberal electorates less likely to vote yes. Liberal voters less likely to vote yes, and that's even when you control for you throw everything in the model. Party identification still matters, but the wrinkle which I think is interesting is that it's not just Liberal or coalition voters which were less supportive than Labor. Greens voters less likely to vote yes, and Greens electorates, when you control for education in particular, less likely to vote yes. So I think it was partly an issue with the lack of bipartisanship, but I think it was a Labor identified position, not a cross party identified issue. So I think we can certainly kind of reflect on the influence which Dutton and Senator Price and others had, but I think we also need to think a little bit about how it was somewhat tied to a particular party. And I think that's a stronger than just a coalition Labor story.
Your data shows that there was, or, I mean, we know, right, the general opinion of Australians, say, a year out from the referendum was support for the proposition. Now, that was pretty soft, but it was around the exact reverse of what we saw in the end, right? What does your data show about what happened to people who had voted Liberal but had said they were favourably inclined? They were the ones who were most likely to be coaxed away from the yes camp.
Yeah, so that's an even stronger kind of argument about the impact of the campaign. So even when you focus on people who in January said they would vote yes, and so there, I guess that's people who are predisposed, who would have a kind of soft support, then throughout 2023, they were the group controlling for other factors who are most likely to say most likely to have changed.
To traverse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I noticed in the data, I think the News poll had a poll that showed that more women voted no than men, which is, I mean, I don't know if your data shows the same, but in all the other, for want of a better word, populist referendums like Brexit or Scottish nationalism or immigration referendums in Europe, it's been consistent that men have voted in a more populist way. Yeah. I'm not saying that voting no here was populist, but it was certainly had a whiff of that.
Yeah.
And I think that is an interesting
So it's certainly, it's counter to our data up until August.
Yes.
And I think that news poll vote, that news poll which you're referring to is closer to the eve of the referendum. So for us, there was a lower level support and a greater drop in support for males up to August.
Mm.
So what I think we is needed is once we've gotten, I think that might be one of the kind of instances where you have a quite a late change if you kind of marry up the news poll and our data, but we won't really know till post. Wow. So the problem with looking at that at the electorate level is that there's very few electorates where you have lots of males or lots of females. So that's one which is hard to pick up with area level data. Mm,
yes.
One of the variables, I think it's the third variable, is the one where you control for age, right? So, and you say the age range of electorates varies from an average of 38.3 in the youngest electorate to 54.4 years in the oldest electorate. And not surprisingly, I guess this seems quite intuitive, electorates with an older population tended to be less likely to vote yes.
Yeah, and I think that's both consistent with our individual level data, but I think it's also kind of consistent with views on what's perceived to be a risky proposition. And so I'm curious, Matt, as to whether that has – I mean, I know the impact of age is in a bit of flux with regards to kind of political spectrum, but I'm curious, as to whether that finding, which was consistent across – our data, news poll data, and also the electorate data, whether that's held in other kind of referendums as well.
Or completely consistently so. But they also, the older demographics tend to be voting more for conservative parties or parties of the right. Mm. And the fact that they take the positions of the parties of the right, I mean, there's not a perfect correlation between party identification and referendum voting, and which is one of the fascinating things.
That's why I'm proposing that people should lose the vote when they hit 60. Right?
You're saying that until you reach 60, and then you're change a little bit. Yeah. But you're right that it is partly to do with party. But even when we kind of look at a Labour voter and then look at the age distribution or a Labour electorate, that I still think age kind of was a key explanation.
I mean, there's some fascinating research that I've been involved in where we do brain scans of people and we try to figure out if there are parts of the brain that are more active when you grow older, and you can actually see that. But that's for a discussion later.
Sure,
that interesting, that sort of research, there's quite a lot of that research and that comes back to some of the stuff that you showed. Normally, people show more empathy if they live in multicultural areas. And that's quite consistent. We've seen that in American and data. And what is interesting here...
As long as they're not bicultural.
Well, quite, yes.
Yes.
But what is interesting here is that we have people who live in areas with lots of indigenous people who tend to be more likely to vote no.
And
that's contrary to what we've seen in sort of the micro level data. Yep. And that is at some level disturbing.
Yeah, and you're right. So in the when you look at views towards migration, those who are most strongly against kind of high levels of migration tend to be those who live in areas with fewer migrants, even if they are born in that particular country. I think that's consistent across countries. So yeah, I think it's what we do need to answer that question, I think, is where we start to overlay your individual characteristics as well as the characteristics of the area in which you live. And I think that's going to start to answer some of those questions.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is with a variable like age is that it is particularly in this context, it can be a bit challenging to interpret, right? Because you're actually talking about potentially quite a few different socialization processes that are happening to people over the course of their lives, which might actually be really shaped by where they live, right? Comparative to others, you might be more likely to be shaped by income because of your overall life chances and so on and so forth.
And it could be changing too, because some research showing that younger people are tending, I think CIS or someone like that came out with some research showing that younger people are tending to move less quickly to the right of the spectrum than they used to.
Yeah, because they're not going through the same socialization process of acquiring property and becoming invested in having property, right?
Yeah.
Which is like one of the drivers, one of the mechanisms that links older voting to conservative property reinforcing parties, right? But we can kind of sort of see how feelings around property acquisition and like not wanting that taken away might play into the referendum debate here. Or we can kind of see how other sort of socially conservative positions over time might play into how you might view this voice proposition, your perception of risk. And I mean, like, the partisanship thing is clearly a big one and it clearly explains an awful lot. But the effect sizes, right, of these potential alternative mechanisms. And, you know, we haven't really even discussed the role of racism or at least anxiety around race. It's not difficult to believe that if you are older, your socialization and your ideas and thinking about race and indigeneity are likely to be quite different from other people. If you don't live in a big city, you might be exposed to different narratives or, fewer contra narratives to what you grew up with. We can kind of see how all of these things might not be the driver of your vote choice in an explicit sense, but maybe influencing how the other factors that might be important to you, it might color those.
Yeah, look, I'm a pretty strong believer in the effects of schooling, if you look at the information which is available in schools now, both through kind of the Reconciliation Australia and their programs, that the exposure to issues related to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, the understanding of history, is far different and far richer for those who finished their schooling in the last couple of years, which would be the younger voters, compared to those who kind of went to school when not only was the framing quite different, but also where just the level of discussion was far less. So I think that's all kind of caught up in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in my mid-30s, and I think the only thing I learnt at school about Indigenous affairs were Dreamtime stories and how sometimes an Indigenous person helped or didn't help an explorer.
And I didn't get the Dreamtime, and I'm older than you, right, and I didn't get the Dreamtime stories. I just got the explorers. Matt, let's bring this back to what you've been doing recently, which is you did a bit of a sort of a qualitative tour of the nation.
Yeah,
and you spoke to people and you got some firsthand sort of explanations of some of these attitudes.
Yes, because I met a lot of people who said before, this is our Brexit moment.
So you sort of what did you go from north to south?
To Tasmania,
right.
Yes.
North to south.
And so not the breadth of the country, but pretty consistently I met with people that I would have expected in a sort of not to have populist views. And I think a lot of people said it was very divisive and so on. Mm. It wasn't as divisive as Brexit. I mean, Brexit, a politician was killed. It was much more so. And you get the sort of like the nursery nurse and the pharmacist and people who typically would be educated and so on. And so saying, well, I might be voting yes, but I'm not quite sure about it. Mm. A lot of the things I sort of heard from people was, so I didn't get previously I'd actually done the same tour and I only ever met one person who admitted to voting for John Howard, who is a used car salesman from Toowoomba, which is kind of what you would expect. But here you get not just the used car salesman, but also people who would normally that, and I think the typical one was that sort of fairness was always coached in that, and said, well, they have more than the average share of members of parliament, why do they need an extra voice? And that's sort of like, and I said, well, don't ask me, and
it's a bollocks argument for a start, but anyway.
well possibly, but I mean, far be it from me to use such terms here on air. My mother might be listening to me.
I apologize.
That's fine Mark. I'm not Australian. I know they're different in linguistics, but I think what I felt was the willingness to actually admit to this, and then, but at the same time, Tweed, who's just on the sort of the Queensland
on the border, Tweed heads.
And somebody said, "I'm going to vote no, but I'm not going to share it on Facebook for fear of the hate." And so the hate sort of would go both ways, and I think there was a lot of sort of sensitivity, and I think in a way, I mean, again, far be it from me to say this, but I think the Australians have become a little bit sort of sensitive of debate. You haven't had a referendum for a long time. And when we had the one in Scotland, it was a bare knuckle fight. When you had the Brexit one, was a bare knuckle fight. And this, as referendums goes, was, you know, there's a lot of disinformation, a lot of sort of people calling the other ones idiots or racists and what have you. But that's part of politics. And
what got me was this sort of, you know, you mentioned in your opening words really that about this question of divisiveness. I mean, a question is by definition, you know, two different options, right?
Yes.
there is, you can divide over that as a group of people, right? In and of itself, that division is not unhealthy. That is the process.
Yes.
And yet it became used. Divisiveness was a pejorative in this debate all the way through, right?
It was deployed very cynically.
It was deployed cynically by the people who chose to not deliver the bipartisanship and then use the fact that there was disagreement
but equally,
as an argument against
there
it.
Might also, you know, agree not to. I mean, there has to be a meeting of minds. And I think what we've seen in other referendums, like the Federation wouldn't have come into being.
Nothing would get done in this country.
And New South Wales actually rejected the first constitution, and then they tweaked it a bit, and they voted yes. Mm. And in Ireland, they talk about the neverendum because they vote no the first time, and then they tweak it.
Yeah.
And I think what is – and then you overcome those differences. And I think Australia – What is now the challenge, really, and Peter Dutton said that we just have recognition. He has to be held to that, and now they have to come back to finding a consensus that everybody can agree to, like they did in New South Wales when it came to federation, like the Irish did when, I think, three times over they rejected part of the European legislation.
But
so
I think the difference is, Matt, is that this question, like the 1967 question, is not about, you know, technical stuff about how we administer parliament or whether or not we join a European community, right? Oh. It is essentially a moral question about amending a wrong to a group of people that have suffered disproportionately in the country, right? And so that is one of the reasons why the Yes campaign was structured the way it was and why, you know, the emphasis on bipartisanship was so important. It wasn't just to see it succeed. It was because it was supposed to be a bringing to kind of together moment, which is why it was such a modest proposal.
Yes.
Right?
But
which was supposed
probably
to
have
be
to have an
a
even
lowest
more
common
modest proposal, which is just recognition. And I think everybody could live
with
that.
Yeah, but I think the problem with that is that, you know, Indigenous people have explicitly rejected that. So it's
and
actually
bear in mind,
dead in
that
the water.
That was explicitly rejected in 1999. It was the second question.
Had, you know,
that that was more the sort of the mateship one and John Howard sort of
It was recognising Aboriginal people as the first peoples of the nation, but in a, as you say, in a kind of a rhetorical sense, in a preamble to the Constitution. Nonetheless, the ACT voted yes for the Republic. It's the only jurisdiction it did, but it didn't even vote yes for that.
No.
That was defeated.
But then maybe
in every
it's time to revisit that one. I mean, Ireland, they voted.
Do you think it should have been two questions, like as in the question here?
I think the second one would just recognition. I think. I mean, I'd be interested to see the polling, but I think the polling suggests that people would vote for recognition, which is a small, meager step and so on, maybe not good enough. But sometimes you have to take those steps and sometimes you have to then learn to see that that's okay and then you move on to the next one. And I think if you want to have some, you know, either you leave it here and people feel, you know, it just, you know, becomes more divisive and more entrenched, or you find something that people can just about live with. Like political compromises are agreements that you can live with.
I think the reality is, though, is that it's quite conceivable that a bipartisan pathway could have been found on this proposition. It is possible that it couldn't have been done this term for the reasons that you've already discussed, but it was the previous, it was the coalition government that put to bed simple constitutional recognition and set up a process to support this process. So I accept what you're saying, Matt, and that might be the way forward. But I don't think, you know, like not doing the like recognition through an institution is, I think, a much stronger counterfactual as to whether or not that was would have been politically palatable. Like I don't see that going forward. And you know, and Albanese does have some responsibility to bear here because he couldn't find a way to get Dutton to agree. Perhaps there was no way. I don't know.
Perhaps there was no way, but perhaps there was.
Perhaps there was.
Yes, I agree. I think that it was. I think there was a lot of political sort of bravado and traditional role playing of parties here. Governments, you know, have a majority. They see themselves as having a mandate, all that sort of thing. And we see this with the way the PM has spoken about it. I promised to do it. I will do it. I did do it. He's even saying that now. I didn't do it as a matter of convenience. I did it as a matter of conviction. That was his line in Parliament.
And there's also opportunism on the other side. I mean, John Howard in '88 was against trial by jury. I mean, that's like one of the most – I mean, that was fought against that in a referendum. And, of course, the referendum was lost and he convinced people that was going to be terrible and then they lost the election. So opposition parties in Australia tend to be more obstructionist than other places, which if I can make a comparison.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. Look, there's so much more we could talk about, but we're run out of time. Thanks so much to both of you for being here, Nick Biddle and Matt Cawtrup. Okay. And thank you, Maria, as always.
Pleasure.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion, frustrating though it no doubt is, because I'm sure there are a lot of people wanting to sort of chime in as you're listening and make alternative points. There are many, many perspectives here, and the data crunching will go on, and we'll learn more and more about it. And Matt, you've got a whole other sort of sample in your armory of referendums to talk about when you travel around the world. And
move
them
on to the next referendum.
Yeah. Do we know who that is yet?
No, there was one in Poland over the weekend but I couldn't attend that one. But
it can't be everywhere. No. No, that's right. All right, that's Democracy Sausage for this week. Until next week, bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.